Hey, Mac, when does deer season start?
Well, if you want the best deer herd possible, Lanny, you need to start right now.
Right now.
That's why we're starting our promotion. I mean, we've got a Deer Season Starts Now promotion on plantbiologic.com where you can pick up our Game Changer soybeans, our forage soybeans, and our spring protein peas. While you're there, you might as well go ahead and pick up some brassicas like our final forage and winter bowls.
Yeah, stock up for the cool season planting right now. Listeners to the GK Podcast, if you use coupon code GKPOD, you can save an additional 10% off our entire selection of warm season, cool season, and clover food plot seed. Get started today and visit plantbiologic.com for an unforgettable fall.
I am Jeff Foxworthy, and welcome to Gamekeeper Podcast. If you want to learn more about farming for wildlife and habitat management, then buddy, you are in the right place. Join the Gamekeeper crew direct from Mossy Oak Land Enhancement Studio as they discuss the latest wildlife and habitat management practices, news, and of course, hunting. There's no telling what you'll learn, but I'm going to tell you, I bet it's interesting. Enjoy.
We're live in 3, 2, 1.
Okay, everybody. I don't know if we're going to be able to get through this one.
Springtime.
It's springtime. We're laughing. Toxic
sleep deprivation is setting in already.
That's exactly right.
Sleep deprivation. It's a brutal this time of year, and I've got a month left.
Yeah, you do. Dudley, you got a smile on your face, a twinkle in your eye.
Yeah.
You look like you're excited.
It's spring. How can
spring,
you not be excited?
Spring has sprung.
Yep.
Yeah, it came quick.
We got Mac 3.0 over here. 3.5, I should say.
Yeah.
How's tennis going, Mac?
You know, about as good as my turkey season so far.
Oh.
Yeah.
That womp.
Let us know next time we'll come cheer for you. That might help.
Bobby's just been playing his violin for you so much.
Yeah,
we do need to go over there and watch him play.
That'd be a lot of fun.
That'd be fun.
Yeah, we can make an episode about that.
I lived through the years of watching my kids compete with Mac, and he's an athlete, relentless competitor too.
Mm-hmm. It's fun.
Relentless.
Hopefully, you don't mess up your Achilles tendon.
So, are you playing? Are you a better than a 3.5, or are you not a 3.5?
I feel like I'm playing up a little bit, but I go in confident, kind of like in the turkey woods, and then most of the time get disappointed.
But you just started really playing tennis hardcore, didn't you?
I did.
See,
I did.
This is like a new thing.
Yeah.
It's another hobby. Okay.
It's pretty good to be a 3.5. It's just, you're just starting it, isn't it?
I don't know.
Y'all should play.
I probably shouldn't.
I'm a 1.0-er.
Nah.
You need to play Daniel's Caroline, too. You need to play.
Mm.
The first time they played, he was like, oh, my gosh, that was embarrassing. My girlfriend just whipped my tail so bad in tennis.
That's how my wife is. She could run me over the court.
Well, so today's podcast. I'm looking over here on the couch. We got a man that I have wanted to have on the podcast since we started this. His name is Barry Smith.
In the house.
Sound the horns.
He's
no introduction. He is the man.
He's a legend from the state of Alabama when it comes to fish, mm-hmm. and a lot of other things, I might add. But Barry is a fisheries scientist. He had a career in fisheries, started with the state of Alabama, moved on to private industry, the American Sport Fish Hatchery. You and Don Keller founded that and worked your tails off for a number of years. He's the first guy I ever knew about to kill a turkey with a 410. He did it. Ooh. I bet he did it 25 years ago, 20 years
with
ago.
With lead.
Yeah. I mean,
that's, right. That's a big difference.
That is a big difference.
Basically, all he does is fly fish. And he likes challenges. And he is when it comes to hunting and fishing, he's good.
Yep.
He's really good.
He's got the salt water down too. Hey.
He does.
He could be on the Dos Equis bottle.
So you hear, Barry, he's very soft-spoken. Mm-hmm. Let me just say this. So he's very soft-spoken. He is a Southern gentleman. He's a Christian. He's a deacon at in Montgomery, the Methodist church there. He ran the camera crew. He just, if the church doors were open, he's there. Great guy. But let me just tell y'all, if you're in the bow of the boat with him and he spots a redfish out there, and he tells you, there it is, it's 36 inches, there it is. And you make a couple of false casts, and then you lay your crab at the tail of that fish instead of the mouth of that fish, you will get the worst cussing you ever got in your life. He changes his whole personality.
I've seen you do that on occasion, Bobby, in the bass pond or on the turkey woods.
Barry, We're glad to have you here.
No doubt.
Well, thank you. Thank you.
This one's been a long time coming. So
it is. I've had several invites, and unfortunately, it's just been I'm a busy man, so it's hard to get away sometimes.
So the fish pond world, there's just there. It's a when guys can manage their pond and do it right, fertilize, stock the right fish continuously. I guess stock some kind of feeder fish. It's a whole different world, isn't it?
It is, and a lot of people don't realize that. Like a lot of other things, you know, they think it's you just got it, and it just magically develops itself. And occasionally, by accident, that happens. But most of the time, if you've got really good fishing in your lake or pond, you put in a lot of effort to achieve that.
Yeah.
It's just like having some turkey woods, you know?
Yeah.
You know, I've said it forever in just my top material possession in life is land. And, you know, doing this, you know, hence gamekeepers. And I've said it forever. People that are looking at their first piece of land or buying a piece of land or getting the number one thing I would do, looking back on my experience, is build the fish pond.
I can't agree more. Man. I mean, you know, growing up turkey hunting, that was the first thing we thought of when we were coming out of the woods was let's go catch some fish.
Mm-hmm. Exactly right.
So Barry, how did you get into the fisheries business?
It's kind of a long story. You know, I started out not really sure whether I was going to get to go to college or not, but I kind of worked my way through. You can't do that today, but back in the old days when things were a little cheaper, you could do that. And I was interested both in wildlife and fisheries. And actually, I started to get a dual degree, but I kind of gravitated toward fisheries. And, hey, lots of things happened between now and back in the old days. So, yeah, here I am.
A couple of weeks ago, we had a guy on that was responsible for restocking turkeys across the state of Mississippi. And Barry, when you worked in Alabama, y'all were doing some restocking some fisheries around the state pretty heavily at that time as well, weren't you?
We were, yeah. Back when I was with the state, we were interested in a lot of things and a lot of things that at that time was kind of progressive. So, you know, we wanted to introduce Florida bass, for instance, and get those in a lot of the reservoirs. And then we were interested in hybrid striving bass. And we kind of developed that program. And, you know, we were known for a lot of things way back in the day. But basically, we were into pond management or lake management, private lake management. And a lot of those things came from Auburn, where most of us went to school over there to get educated in fishery science, and we just kind of proceeded from there. And so we did a lot of public water stockings back in the day. And my mentor and my boss at that time was Sam Spencer. And he was a very progressive thinker, and we got into a lot of things that just had not been done before, and a lot of those were very successful.
You know, this time of year, we're thinking turkeys.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of people that are thinking crappies.
Oh, 100%. Mm-hmm.
So
that's why I'm such a bad crappie fisherman.
Barry, can you tell us what's going on with the crappies right now and the temperature guys need to think about if they're for like public rivers and stuff?
Well, there are a couple of things that are associated with crappie spawning. And crappie spawning is one of the times when, you know, back in the day, is when we used to find those fish up on the banks, both in private ponds and in public waters, or at least trying to move up to where they can begin spawning. And so that happens in the springtime, and it happens this time of year. And typically in March, around the full moon, and the moon does have some influence on spawning, a lot of different species. So, you know, a week before, a week after the full moon, and we're coming up on the full moon now, and during that time, and when the temperatures begin to elevate to what the threshold for spawning is for these fish, then that starts in the time. And then it lasts for maybe a month or so. And then as that ends, then the crappie move off the bank and they move out to deeper water. All you who are crappie fishermen know how this works. And you go look for some treetops that are in 10 or 12, 15 feet of water, depending on what lake you're fishing in. And you find those things after they spawn, post-spawn, all congregated in a school. But what a lot of people don't know is that before the spawning takes place, the males move in first, just kind of like the bass. And then they kind of prepare the beds. And so the area for the females to come in, but the females are not far from the males. And if you're fishing in a reservoir or a pond that's got sloughs or little pockets in there, a lot of times these fish are schooled up out in those pockets, out in the middle of those things, deep. And if you had a depth finder, you can find those things out there, you know, while they're schooled up before they move in. And you hear a lot of people say, well, yeah, call me some black crappie today. You know, those things are just so black. They got black fins and stuff. Well, that's not necessarily black crappie. That's the fact that a lot of species of fish have characteristics that develop during the spawning season. And this melanistic or black color that develops into the fins are primarily males. Hmm. And so when you're on the bank and catch these things, you know, everybody think, I got me a black crappie. But really, it's just a male. Hmm. It could be a white crappie, but they develop some melanistic characteristics like that.
How about that?
And then a female doesn't turn black. Okay, she doesn't have any melanistic characteristics. And so this is a little thing that, as a scientist, we call sexual dimorphism. A little term I'll throw out to you.
I've heard it before.
No, I've heard that one time.
I think I've heard Dudley.
I know I've made the mistake on the black crappie in the past.
Right.
Yeah. You see, it's darker. You assume it's a black crappie.
So what you stock for people is black crappie, though, right? Primarily.
There are two different species of crappie, a black crappie and a white crappie.
Right.
The black crappie do better in deep reservoirs. The white crappie are found more likely in river run impoundments, like in the Alabama River, for instance, in our state.
Right.
And some of the bigger rivers over here would have more of the white crappie in there. So, yeah, there's two different species, but if we're stocking it in your pond, Toxie, for instance,
right,
we would provide black crappie. They'd do better in the ponds.
That's what I thought. Yeah. So.
But you got to be careful putting crappie in a pond, don't you?
You do. And this is a mistake that's commonly made by pond owners that really don't know any better. You know, all of us have fished ponds that have good bream, good bass, and good crappie populations. Okay. Sometimes those happen by accident, but mm-hmm. if you really want it to happen for intention, then you come in and don't let your buddy come back from the river and dump a bucket full of mature males and females in your pond. Okay. Because this is a time of the year that's really critical for that mm-hmm. because the crappie are spawning right now, but the bass haven't spawned yet. Okay. They're going to. Their primary spawn will be in April. But the bass is what controls everything in your pond or your private lake. Okay, they control the population, whatever's in there. What happens when you have crappie, if you put in adults, is that they spawn almost a month before the bass do. And those little crappie fry, as they develop into fingerlings, are never small enough for the young of the year bass to eat. And so they overpopulate.
Uh-huh.
And this is what causes the major problem. If you come in and stock fingerlings in there, you don't have that problem.
Okay. Conversely, the bream is the perfect partner because they spawn like a month or whatever after the bass.
That's right.
And the little teeny bass bream fry are perfect for the bass.
Huh. Exactly. Exactly.
The time and other, he taught me that, so I can act smart in front of him. He taught me that forever ago. So
yeah.
It was from him. And you did, though. I just always wanted to do it. There was a place that was, I thought, perfect to kind of create an oxbow or natural type lake because I knew it would flood occasionally, once every 10 years, maybe a little bit. But it had a little bit of creek drainage in it, not much, but I let them handle that. And so, you know, we didn't think it was going to turn out. They stocked bream and crappie first, and then there was so much decaying matter, and then the acidity was so high. He said, "I'm just going to wait. I'm scared you might lose." But they literally that's the kind of service and honesty and integrity. Handling said, "Well, drove all the way there a couple of hours to deliver the fish. When the guy tested the water, called Bear. He said, "Don't charge him anything. Just take them back. It's too big a risk to stock them." Right. And lo and behold, he said they might not, but it's just too big a risk to charge you and you were going to put stripers in there with the bass to maintain, sure, you know, kind of keep the population down more. And turns out, I think by luck, that we didn't do that. Some bass got in there naturally, but it also, when you shocked it and texted it, it had some of those grinnell and stuff in there. So I think it naturally is keeping the population more in check. And it's a, you know, this thing's a half a mile long. Bobby's fished it, loves to fish, doesn't
yeah.
it? But we got lucky, and it turned out great and kind of replicated, you know, what you would find in a natural oxbow lake. And so we love the place. It's a great lake. Now, is it going to be our best lake to catch a giant bass? No, but there's a healthy population, and they're getting along. I think you can tell me, my grin will probably be here helping me.
That's a predator that controls some of that overpopulation, yeah. so that's mm. true.
Can those things really live in the mud, dried out mud for months?
Not dried out mud, but they can live in a lake that doesn't look like it's inhabitable.
Yeah.
So these can be air breathers. And so if you've got what you think no other fish would live in, a grinnell or a bowfin can live in that muck and stuff.
Boy, they can bust a spinnerbait.
And they're so prehistoric looking.
Yeah,
they
are.
Just look like a dinosaur.
Yeah. They will bust a spinnerbait, but you don't want to be handling them.
No.
They're
like catching a saltwater fish. Mm-hmm. They're so kind of, you know, so much energy.
Yeah, don't try to lip one.
See these people? When the clock strikes 5, it's not the end. It's just the beginning. They have to do these things. They have to do those things. Enter the all-new LS Tractor MT2 and MT2E, a relentless force of innovation. Redesigned with a new hood and cab built for comfort and visibility, with enhanced lifting capacity to get the job done. Making these people the ones everyone else calls those people. Visit your local LS Tractor dealer today.
Moultrie has pioneered the game management category. Today, Moultrie is one of the best-selling brands of feeders and seeders in the world, and they continue to innovate with new technology that gamekeepers will rely on. Moultrie products are always field-tested and designed for hunters by hunters, combining forward-thinking innovation with time-tested practicality. Moultrie, first in feeders since 1979. All right, so guys, Moultrie is offering our listeners a 15% site-wide discount at MoultrieFeeders.com. Use code MossyOak with a capital M, MossyOak, at MoultrieFeeders.com and get that 15% discount. So going back, so the crappie spawn first, then the bass are second, and then the brim are going to follow multiple times throughout the summer.
Yeah, and the next thing to spawn in there that's native is the shellcracker, okay, or red ear. It's commonly called a red ear, but most people call them shellcrackers just because they do eat
chinkapins. Is that the strawberry that you
I grew up calling them chinkapin?
And then that's a common name, especially if you get Mississippi Edge into Louisiana, you know, they're all chinkapins in Louisiana. There's no shellcracker.
That's the unsung hero of a great pond, too, because they're not the same. You don't necessarily don't eat the fish feed like the bluegills do as much. And then, you know, you don't really catch them a lot on crickets. It's worms primarily, isn't it?
Worms primarily. That's right.
So, but boy, they are just delicious table fare and so much fun to catch.
Big, handsome fish, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they are. They are. And the thing about shellcracker that most people don't realize. And if you catch some this spring, this is something you can do, okay? When you cut that fish's throat open and look down inside there, you'll see that there's a set of molars, top and bottom, that they use to crush those snails with.
Wow.
Or any other type of mollusk. And you've caught 1,000 of them. But I'll bet you've never cut one open to look at that. So next time you have one, just take your scissors or a knife and just cut him open and look in there. You'll see two pads way back in the throat there. And each of those pads have some little tubercular stuff on there that are hardened. And when they suck that shell in from a snail or any type of mollusk that they can get their mouth on, they just take it and crush it. And then they spit the shell out, and then they absorb the meat that's inside there. But you say,
that's fascinating.
Learn something
you look
new
at
every
that,
day.
You know, well, hey.
Shell cracker.
Yeah. Right. I'll ask you
makes a lot more sense now.
It seems like, if I remember right, you would usually use 10%. Is that about right?
That's about right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, when you're stocking, say, the brim or the 90% brim, 10% shell cracker, chinkapin, whatever. It just seems like they maintain that. They don't go away. They will get overpopulated. But it seems like if you do the shocking test or you fish, they seem to be so like in balance all the time almost, you know?
They do. And one of the reasons is because the shellcracker typically have one primary spawn, and that's during the spring. And they spawn a month before the blue eel begin to bed. So there is some bedding activity there. Occasionally you'll get a little crossing there. That's not unusual to see one that's got both bluegill and shellcracker in it. You see that occasionally, but
a hybrid.
Typically, it's a hybrid. But typically, they spawn a month, full moon, a month before the bluegill begin to bed.
And are they usually deeper than bluegill when they're spawning?
Not necessarily. You know, what you will find is that these things will be in little points that have treetops or something. They'll get in those treetops. If you were to lower that lake and look at it, say, like in June, okay, after the bluegill had made their initial spawn, you'll see the difference in the beds, okay? The shellcracker will make a bed as big as a bass.
Wow.
And the bluegill will make a small bed. Maybe like a teacup, a little saucer for a cup. But the shellcracker, especially the bigger ones that get closer to a 3/4 to a pound, will make a bed that will be bigger than a dinner plate. Hmm. Okay. And they will not touch each other.
Hmm.
The bluegill will bed right next to each other. And you see those beds, you've seen them in clear ponds. There'll be 10 or 15 or 20 of them or more, and they'll all be touching each other, just one after another. But the shellcracker, they don't touch. They may be close, but you'll see 4 or 5 beds, maybe more than that, but it'll be on a point. Typically, they can be deeper than bluegill, but or if there's a treetop or some limbs or something out there, they'll get in amongst that, and they'll bed inside there. And so they're really never in like a bluegill would pick a nice flat place. And I've seen 50 or more beds as you have too, and in these ponds, the shellcracker are different from that.
Hmm.
And the other thing that shellcracker like is they like ponds with vegetation.
Hmm.
Okay, we don't like vegetation in them. Hard to fish, but some what we call as a scientist macroinvertebrates. These bigger insects get on this type of vegetation. So just for instance, if you've got cara or you got something besides algae in there that grows in there, that's an attachment surface for these insects that shellcracker eat. They'll get snails on there, but they'll also have these larger insects that'll attach to that. And that's what shellcracker likes.
So if you've got kind of an isolated spot, you know, I guess the whole lake's covered in something, then they're just spread out randomly anyway. But if you've got a concentrated spot, then that might be your best place to try fishing too, isn't it?
It could be. Yeah. Sure could be. I mean, we see this a lot, not just in private ponds, but in public reservoirs. For instance, I go up into Tennessee to fish in the spring, usually the first full moon in May, and we catch shellcracker up there. I mean, those that are over a pound. Some of them pound and a half or even closer to 2 pounds. Big,
yummy.
Huge shellcracker.
Wow. Yeah, they seem to get bigger in a natural environment, whereas bluegill, you almost have to manage heavily to get them really big. That's just my experience.
Well, that's a correct experience, because it's exactly what happens. And if they've got a good bit of vegetation in a situation where they live, there's a lot of big succulent insects for them to eat in addition to snails that get onto these.
I can't remember catching one at the brim, the fish feeder.
No, they don't feed on artificial feed very well. You can catch some occasionally eating that, but most of the time they don't.
So Barry, my dad was a big fisherman, and he just loved shellcrackers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But he always used porcupine quills.
Right.
And would bounce them just right where they would set up. And you would watch this as a kid. I can remember just trying to, and I could not hardly see the movement of the, but he'd say, "You got one."
Right.
But so how is that fish taking it differently, where you need something so sensitive as a porcupine quill to
– So you're referring to using it as a cork.
As a cork,
right.
Okay, yeah.
I was
as
just
a cork.
Letting
I'm
the
sorry.
Listeners know.
Yeah, my
dad did.
My uncle, great-uncle, and my granddad both used porcupine quills for brim and –
Yeah. Right.
So I thought it was just a shellcracker thing. Maybe it's a.
It's not. Back in the day, back in the old days when you used to go with your granddaddy, you know, but
a long time ago.
It's a real long time ago. And so that a lot of people use this. You know, they use those quills for that. And then you could watch that quill and just mm-hmm. stand up. But one thing about shellcrackers, they don't hit that thing hard like a bluegill will. Okay, there's a difference in the way they feed. The shellcracker sucks that up rather than just going after it right. and biting it. It's where you can really feel that thing. So a lot of times, just the way we fish those things, a lot of times is we'll use a drop shot technique. So you put a little lead on the end of your worm, come up from that just a little bit, maybe 12 inches or so, and hook a little fly or hook a little worm on there, whatever. And when you drag that through, a lot of times that thing will just stop. And then you just have to pull back on it. You feel resistance and you go ahead and set the hook. You got something on there. Mm. But a bluegill hits that thing, he hits it.
It's gone.
It's yeah. gone. Doop. You know, boom. And you can feel that really well. So yeah. there's a difference in the way that they feed and a difference in the way that they things that they eat.
Making me want to go fishing.
Yeah, me too, honestly.
Yeah. So Lanny just got a pond.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Just got a place, just got a
5-acre lake.
Yeah. So
cool.
What would you say to somebody that's just got one? And I don't think, Lanny, has there been any management ever done on the
Not that I know of. You know, it's been there. I know it's been there probably since the 40s. So it's an old lake.
Old lake.
In a river bottom, and it's pretty deep.
But it doesn't flood there, though.
No, it does not flood. So it doesn't flood at all.
Does he need to shock it and see what's going on?
That's the best thing to do. You know, you can get an indication out of that if you fished it pretty heavily.
Mm-hmm.
Lanny, probably not you by yourself.
Not yet.
Invite some friends over that know how to fish and get those people out there.
Yeah.
And fish not only for bass, but look for your bluegill and shellcracker
mm-hmm.
too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the time to catch shellcracker is in the spring.
Okay.
Because once you pass that spawning time, those things are who knows where, but typically out in deeper water mm-hmm. that you would never even think about fishing in.
So would you just kind of do it like a wildlife survey? I mean, sure. just X amount. This is how many days we fished, how many times we fished, and this is the breakdown of the species?
Yeah, keep track of what you catch and the size range of what you harvested mm-hmm. out of there during your fishing experience so mm-hmm. that you know what size of bluegill you've got. And same thing if you catch any shellcracker, but don't fish with crickets, you know. Shellcracker like worms.
Gotcha.
But, you know, but how's he going to know if he's got some invasive fish he doesn't need? I mean, some of the small fish you might not even catch. I mean, it just seems like to me that's in your backyard. Let's all face it.
Yeah.
Doing it right, you need to do this.
I would want to do a shocking boat survey.
Yeah. So, you know, you might have, there might be loaded with crappie you don't even know.
Right.
If you got them in there, you got a whole different set of problems, you know.
Well, the other thing I want to like get in front of Barry is he's going to catch a big old flathead catfish out of the river, and his boys are going to say, "Let's take it."
You're literally reading all my questions because I was going to ask about putting flatheads in there.
I know the answer to that one.
Let's go ahead and tell
I've already asked him that question before. I can tell you.
I mean, you know.
Okay, so you've caught a flathead out of the river.
He's a big flathead guy.
That's what he does.
Okay, do you notice how wide the mouth is?
Oh yeah.
Okay, well, let me give you an example of how this relates to your lake, okay? A largemouth bass can eat a bluegill about a third of its length. So mm-hmm. if you've got a 12-inch largemouth, it can eat a bluegill between 3 and 4 inches, okay? Flathead catfish can eat the size of bluegill you want to fillet and take home.
Mm, that must be why they taste so good.
They're a very efficient predator, and their mouth is so wide, they can eat something really big.
Hmm.
They just turn that thing sideways and suck it in. So you could have 7-8-inch bluegill in there, and if you had a flathead in there, it could eat those up.
The 7 or 8 inches itself.
So they grow, didn't I hear one time they grow like 7 pounds in the first year or something like that? Some crazy amount.
All that depends on the food supply. Right. So, you know, that's food dependent, but they can grow at a very rapid rate.
So don't dump any crappie from the river or any flatheads from the river.
No, don't.
All your plans
I know
have
it.
Just got to
X. He wasn't that diplomatic when I asked him about it. He said, under no circumstances.
That's exactly right.
Lenny, I have to tell you, hunting with you, you've got your phone in your pocket. You're constantly checking on X.
Yep. Very variable key features all in those things. It really is. From the compass mode to recent imagery, I mean, it really helps you understand where you are spatially, where you're headed, where a turkey is, where he was. It's a heck of a tool to use in the spring woods.
I didn't realize that they're updating these maps every couple of weeks.
Yeah, I'd have never known about that clear cut that you were hunting if I didn't have that recent imagery.
Well, you know, and you could share some waypoints with me.
I could share some points with you. You're exactly right.
I mean, it has that capability.
It does have that sharing capability, which is great. You know, you're wanting to show me where your goblin turkeys are.
Oh, man. You know, Onyx, it's a great app.
It's a great app.
So guys can go to onyxmaps.com/hunt and use code Mossy Oak to get 20% off.
There you go.
I'm a big fan of Onyx.
I am too. I remember a lot of people had catfish ponds when I was growing up. Is anybody doing that anymore?
They are, and there's still some room for catfish in there. My suggestion is always this. If you've got a small pond, like less than an acre, and you want a place for your kids to fish, or even yourself, where you'd like to catch some catfish, maybe have a catfish fry.
100%. That's okay. What I was aiming
for. So don't put them in your 10-acre lake, okay? And the reason is this, okay? Is that if you stock them from somebody who's got some fingerlings, 6, 8, 10 inches, you put them in there, the first year they're going to grow really nice. And so they're going to be the perfect size that you want to catch and eat. Okay. But then after you had a fish fry or two, then you kind of forget about that. Mm-hmm. And then the next thing you know, those catfish are, instead of being a pound or a pound and a half, have grown to 3 or 4 pounds. And the next thing you know, they've grown to 5 or 6 or 6 or 8 pounds. And the larger they get, the more difficult they are to catch. Mm-hmm. And once they get above about 2 pounds, they begin to compete with your largemouth for food.
Gotcha.
Okay. Even if you're feeding, they're piscivores. And once they get to that size that they can eat your bluegill, whatever else you've got in there that your bass are going to eat, then they begin to affect the growth of your bass. Mm-hmm. And so you end up with a lake that you throw out a little feed and you see a dozen of these big catfish that are 8 to 10 pounds that come up. They're channels. That's what they normally stock in there. And the next thing you know, you catch one, maybe two, then they quit biting. That's all you catch. You come back next week, see the same thing. But they become more and more difficult to catch, and they stay in there, and they continue to deplete that food supply you have for your bass. So that's one of the reasons I don't recommend stocking anything in lakes any bigger than an acre.
Gotcha. And if you got an acre, just dedicated all the way to catfish.
Primarily catfish.
Gotcha. Makes sense.
Yeah.
Could you do a bigger lake with catfish, but only – if you're dedicated to the catfish, or do you think it's just going to be too much?
You could.
Just don't expect anything from your other fish.
Yeah, well, actually, you could do just a catfish lake if you were to.
Yeah.
You know, and that's one of the things that you can do.
Now you'd have to feed those fish.
Yeah. Right? Yeah.
You can put some forage in there for them, but you probably wouldn't need any bass in there. But what a lot of people don't realize is if you get a catfish-only lake, you get a depression or a piece of a log or a stump or an old tire, those catfish will spawn in there. And then what's going to eat those little fingers?
Nothing.
Nothing. You're right, Toxie.
Overpopulated again.
Yeah, so then you end up with a bunch of little catfish. It's hard to get things to work out right, you know, if you've got a larger lake. So
let's do this, because I want to get you to tell – one of the things that's always fascinated me about Barry is he may not have invented fish pond fertilizer, but he perfected it.
Yes.
And can you kind of carry us back to the day when this whole process started with you and Don? And let's talk about how important it is to fertilize a pond, but then kind of go how you guys got into these really fine ingredients and these specialized micronutrient packages that you developed. Yeah. And let's just kind of go there, because that's so important to the health of a pond.
Well, it is. And there have been studies on just fertilizing ponds, okay, since the 1950s, okay. Dr. Homer Schwingel at Auburn was one of the pioneers in this thing. And so he had a bunch of small ponds that were replicates. And he was really an agronomist. So he was really into replicating stuff so that he could verify what was going on. So one of the things that he discovered was that if you fertilize a pond, you can triple the production of fish in that pond by adding fertilizer to it.
Hmm. That's a big number.
That's a huge number.
It's a huge number.
Man, 50% is a huge number.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Tripling down.
Much less triple.
No. Yeah, but tripling. And this is all documented. I mean, he has data to prove this stuff. And what this fertilizer does, it just starts at the basic level, okay, of food production, which is really bacteria and insects, okay? And these feed off of plankton, phytoplankton. So as you increase the amount of food for those, then you increase the amount of plankton, the amount of insects you produce, and then this goes right on up the chain there from the basic production of bluegill to the production of bass, because the more bluegill you have and the bigger sizes you've got for the bass that you have in there, then the more you can produce. So it's just a pretty simple thing. So we were around this for a long time, and most of the original fertilizer stuff was done with granular fertilizer.
Yeah, okay. I remember my dad going around with a coffee can and super triple phosphate.
That's right.
Yeah. Flinging it out,
okay.
Or people had these, like, baskets, and they would put a...
Platforms.
Yeah.
And cut a bag open and lay it on.
That's more advanced.
Yeah, that's right.
Phase two.
It is more advanced. So what happens a lot of times if you, regardless of whether you're using 2025 or whether you're using triple super phosphate in some older ponds that works really well, but the way not to apply that is to go around with a coffee can.
Yeah. I bet, 95% of it ends up sticking in the mud on the bottom.
Well, it does. It doesn't dissolve in there, or it becomes bound in the bottom muds, okay? So if you put it on a platform, or in the case of triple superphosphate, you don't even need a platform. You can take the bag, okay, and cut the whole top side of it out and slip it into the water that's going to be about 12 inches deep, preferably put it on a point that gets a lot of wave action, it dissolves out of that bag. You know, so the guy calls in, he says, "Hey, I did what you told me to, and I cut that sack, and I put it in there. And then, well, I went back and looked at it. Well, there's stuff in the bottom. I'm not using, I'm paying for something, and it's not getting in the water."
Right.
I said, "No, what you're paying for is a filler that goes into that. You're not paying for the nutrients."
Right.
See? And so in his mind, he thought that some of his greens weren't really dissolving in there. So then we went from there, and then Swingle developed a technique of suspending that stuff on a platform, maybe putting that platform 12 to 18 inches deep, let the wind and wave action dissolve it. And that's a good way to put that out. And the fertilizer they decided on back then was like 2025. Okay. It's a good clover fertilizer. So you can use that in your pond. And so that's one of the, when we got into this thing, we started looking at better ways to put this out so that we didn't have to carry a 50-pound sack of fertilizer out there. And you got a 10-acre pond, you want to use a sack of that per acre in there. Well, shoot, that's a lot of weight.
A lot of weight.
To carry around. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so you get some little guy like me that doesn't like to lift all that much. And, you know, we like to look at something else. And so we started looking into other types of fertilizers, and we found some stuff that was completely water soluble, and that you could really increase the proportions of the parts of the fertilizer you wanted to use and incorporate into that water soluble stuff. And so now we've got something like Perfect Pond Plus. Mm-hmm. And that stuff, you know, you can put out 5 to 7 pounds per acre. Beats the heck out of putting a 50-pound bag in.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So, and you can pour this out because it dissolves in the upper 2 feet of the water column. And so you can take it and do like your granddad did. You could put it in a coffee can, or you can just pour it out of the edge, you know, from the boat and just go back and forth across that pond, and it dissolves in the upper 2 feet of the water column, and then the wind moves this dissolved fertilizer all around the pond. Hmm. So it's a much better way to put things out. And so as Don and I started looking at this and decided what else we could do to improve this, well, one of the things that we thought about was incorporating some micronutrients in there. You know, and they use this in different types of horticulture, different nutrients and micronutrients that have seemed to be very important in the growth of a lot of plants. So we figured, well, growth of plankton is a plant. Let's see if we can incorporate some of this in there. And so that's some of the things we did. And as we developed this fertilizer, we wanted to talk to people who were experts in fertilizers and see what type of ingredients we needed to combine in there that were dissolvable. And so there are a lot of companies that make this stuff, but we have the most dissolvable ingredients in Perfect Pond that there is out there.
Yeah, a lot of those micros are usually unavailable. And I'm not sure, and you know, when you're dealing with soils, they refer to it as chelated,
right,
to make them more available. I don't know if that's what's used in the Perfect Pond Plus, though, but it's in an available form.
It's in an available form. That's correct. And the ingredients that go into that stuff are the most dissolvable that you can get. Now, they're more expensive, mm-hmm. okay? And that's why most people don't put them in there, because they want to do the cheapest thing. So
this is an amazing product. Honestly, we have so many biologic products over the years. It really may be our very best product that we sell.
No doubt about it.
Yeah, we never get a complaint about it.
No.
It's a great
product.
And once a guy tries it, he won't go away. Yeah. So yeah. Tell a guy how he can look at his water and tell if he needs to fertilize. Seeky disc, is that correct?
I guess clear water is not a good thing.
No, and a lot of people don't realize that because they won't. Well, my wife wants to swim here.
Yeah.
I said, well, get her a membership.
Well, do you want to grow big bass or do you want
to go swimming?
You can still swim in fertile water.
That's right. You can.
You don't want to be able to see your toes anyway.
That's right.
But it's got to be green. We want it to be green,
but on the other hand, you can get too green. So what you need to do is to try to check the visibility in there. You can't just go look at it. What do you think, Clyde? Is this greener than it was last time?
I can see 3 foot in there.
That's what I always do.
That's exactly what I was going to do.
Man, he sticks his foot.
It's kind of like the glove with herbicides.
Yeah, but everybody can't buy one of those rings, Bobby. So, I mean, I think there's a simple way to check.
Simple way to do that. One simple way is to, you can get a yardstick, mm-hmm. okay? That's measured in inches and millimeters if you're into that. But put you a piece of white plastic on the end of it, just with a tack. Stick it down in the water and see how far you can push it down until it disappears. Okay? What you're really looking for, ideally, is something that's going to be between 20 and 24 inches. The hotter it gets in the summer, the more I like to see it extended so that you don't develop something that's going to be 14 or 15 inches. Mm-hmm. Okay. That's when you're looking for trouble in the middle of the summer when it gets hot and you get these thunderstorms coming in. And so you don't want your pond to turn over, but you don't want to have a deprivation of oxygen. You do it like that. If you read some of the old literature developed in the 1950s, and listen, I work for the state of Alabama and that was our Bible. Okay. So it said 18 inches. That's too thick. Okay. So let that thin out a little bit in the summer. It's okay to have it in the springtime, get a good heavy bloom on it. That's good. That's when a lot of your fish are hatching out. They need all that plankton. But as you go into the summer, let it clear up to about 24 inches. And I like to do that before I even fertilize. Okay. So let it clear to that depth before you begin to fertilize. If your lake has got good alkalinity in it and it blooms off real easy, when you get into the summer, just use a half ration and see what happens. Once it clears to 24, fertilize it again. If you think you can get by with a full level of fertilization, then you can do that, but it's better to be safe than sorry most of the time. So how often should
we do this?
You don't do it monthly, okay? Mm-hmm. You don't put it on a schedule where you go in every 3 weeks. Hey, Clyde, it's time to fertilize.
Put some more out.
That's right. Put some more. I don't care if you just put some more. That's what the book says.
Yeah.
So just go in there and check your visibility and fertilize by visibility. That's the proper way.
So if you can see it 24 inches down,
add some fertilizer.
Add fertilizer.
Right.
All
right.
And when do you normally begin fertilization in the spring? Like at a certain temperature or?
Well, if you read the books that were published in 1952, okay, it says you start in February. Okay. That's wrong. The reason they wanted to start in February is because they had all kinds of algae and weed problems. And so if they could develop a bloom on there that shaded out the sunlight from the bottom, then that deterred the development of algae and other types of vegetation. So, but in my opinion, for what that's worth, I like to wait till April. And the reason is because water temperature is warmed up enough that you get a good response to your fertilization at that period of time. So I think you're wasting a lot of the earlier applications if you start in February. You get February, March, you know. You try to go skinny dipping that time of the year, buddy.
Oh, yeah.
A little chilly.
Yeah. Yeah, what about, you know, we've got such a warmer spring right now than we've had. We did have a colder night for one night, but pretty much looking at 75-degree days or so for a week straight coming up. What water temperature do you want to see? Just approximately.
I'd like to see in the mid-60s.
Okay. Yeah,
that's what I'm looking for. Okay. So right now, your water temperatures are running in the high 50s.
Right.
Okay. Just a little bit early. That wouldn't hurt to put out now, but I just like to wait till about mid-April to start fertilizing.
Who is this Clyde guy he keeps talking about? Sounds like you, Ronnie.
It might be. I'm probably kin to him.
I think he must have had a bully when he was in school named Clyde or something.
So Barry, help explain this, because this is one thing that kind of, when we started learning about fertilizer, some of the older ponds, Lanny, yours may fit this, drains off the top.
Yeah.
And if you get a bloom going and you get a big rain, you can lose your bloom.
You can.
And then, but some of the more modern, newer ponds drain off the bottom.
It
don't affect that as much.
It does not. And you can do this on any established pond. Okay. It doesn't matter if it's old like you've got, Lanny. So it was built, maybe it was built in the 50s or 60s. You can come in and do a siphon system in there. Okay. And what that is that's a pipe. You don't have to break the dam to put it in. You just go, the pipe lays right underneath the surface of the dam. Okay. So you put deep enough that you can drive over it with your truck or tractor. But the front end of that siphon that goes down into the lake goes down toward the bottom. You just run that pipe straight down the dam until you get in some really deep water. And then the backside of the siphon, it works just like a regular siphon does. You know, the backside needs to be a third the length of the front. And you're pulling off the bottom of that stuff. So when the water rises up, it goes out this automatic siphon system and sucks that water off the bottom. That way, that's below where your plankton is. And so it sucks the bad water really off the bottom of your pond and allows that plankton to stay in the upper 3 or 4 feet of water.
Nice. I got some work to do.
Yeah. That sounds like the best scenario for a guy trying to really manage
it. It's the best. You know, in the old days, back when we started with these stand-up pipes, you know, they had a drain valve on it. Most of those that were put in back in the 50s or 60s have rotted out because they used corrugated pipe.
Oh, yeah.
You know, they thought it would last for 20 years. Now, all them guys that designed it's going to be retired by then, so it was no big deal. But, you know, using a PVC pipe or stand pipe. They started with a pipe that went over that upright, okay, and it was elevated 3 or 4 inches or 6 inches above the surface of the water, and so it kept logs and stuff from getting over your stand pipe and stopping that. And then that sleeve that went over there, because it was above the water level, sucked water from the bottom of that sleeve. See, so depending on how deep your sleeve was, if it was 6 feet, it sucked it out from 6 feet below the surface. And so that was a pretty good deal back in the day. But today, the way to go is a siphon system. It's an automatic system, works perfectly. If the pond comes up, it siphons. When the pond goes down, there's a little air brake on that thing. And as soon as it breaks the surface of the water, the siphon quits. So it works. It works flawlessly most of the time.
Mac, you got a question?
I do. So When I think about fertilizing, I immediately go to food plots, and we preach soil test.
Sure.
So is there a similar process with ponds, or is or do you just kind of fertilize them the same?
No, there is a similar process. And one of the things that happens here is the same thing happens in your food plot, okay? If the pH of your water is too acidic, that prevents your plants from taking up the fertilizer you put out in your food plot. Everybody knows that. You know, you lime those things. Well, the same thing happens to your pond. If your pond has got acidic soils, especially bottom soils in there, then the way to make your fertilizer more efficient is to neutralize that acidity in the bottom of your lake. And there are a couple of ways to do that, but one of the primary ones that we use is to use a liming barge. And we use, you know, natural ground lime and put that out and cover the whole lake, the whole bottom of the lake. And that neutralizes the acidity of the bottom, and that makes your water quality more suitable to grow plankton when you apply fertilizer.
I will say and interject what he says, that if you're thinking about it and you're building a pond, and there's a lot of people out there building ponds these days, save yourself a lot of time and trouble and money. Do a soil test when it's dry before you let the water in. And sure. Line. I've seen y'all do it for people a bunch of times. Sure. Line that thing with the lime it needs, plus some before you ever put it. It's so much easier. And actually probably a little more accurate in maintaining it in the history of the pond. You may have to come back depending on the soil and how much decays and all in the future, but you're way out of the game to do it before it fills up with water.
That's exactly what we did with your uncle's pond when we renovated that. And as that pond was dry, we were adding structure and stuff to it. I said, look, take your equipment and build you a road inside the pond that you can drive a lime truck over. And get that all the way around the edge of the pond and make sure you can cover the whole thing. Well, they just got some bulk lime delivered just like they would put in there.
They're not 5 miles from the lime plant, so that worked out good for them.
Yeah, and so that really works out well. So you can add that, and you cannot add too much. So if your soil sample comes back, like most of them do that I've ever sent in, and said, Mr. Smith, your plot here, you need a ton to the acre or 2 tons. Just go ahead and put 5 tons.
Yeah, you're better off. Okay, you're right. Well, there's so much stuff's going to decay in that pond. Especially I think if you have a lake surrounded by trees and all those leaves
exactly
and stuff in there, which you have, it's going to happen a lot faster. You're way ahead of the game to lime that thing to death.
Exactly.
The Ferminator is the industry's most versatile piece of food plot equipment, allowing plotters to do every step of the process, working the soil, adding seed and soil supplements, and compacting. From start to finish, with a single implement, it's hassle-free by design. Set it for the seed size and simply drive the tractor, and the Ferminator does the rest. Check it out at theferminator.com.
Hey guys, Dudley from Gamekeepers here. I want to tell you about the all-new Gunner Dog Bowl. It's designed for home and built for travel. It's customizable, leak-resistant, light on weight, solid on durability, and rust-proof. Like other Gunner products, they're made in Nashville and designed for everywhere.
Nosler is known for their bullets, and now they're making suppressors. Nosler suppressors are made for hunting. Adding a Nosler suppressor to your rifle will make you a quieter, more accurate, and more effective hunter. Protect your hearing and disturb less game with a Nosler suppressor. The time to hunt quiet is now. Learn more at Nosler.com.
What's the cutting-edge technology in farm pond and pond management for sport fish, growing big bass? What's the latest?
Well, the latest thing is it is a little different from what you read in the booklet published in 1952. Imagine that.
That they probably hadn't updated yet.
Yeah, no, it's still the same as it was, but they just reprint. But the things have changed a little bit. Okay, things have changed since when you went fishing with your granddaddy. Okay, or your dad. All right, back in those days, we were looking to catch whatever we would catch that were big enough to eat and take those home and clean them and cook them. Okay, well, Today, things have changed, not just from that standpoint, but, you know, my first wife wouldn't let me cook fish in the house. Of course, she's not around anymore.
Yeah.
I'm not going to touch that one.
So what's different is that back in those days, it wasn't the objective to catch big bass. Okay, the objective was to provide food for these poor farmers mm-hmm. who had a pond out there that they used to water their cattle with or just had a site that they built in there. They weren't after big fish. They were after trying to provide more protein for that family as a way of sustenance, okay? So now, since very few people get to cook fish in the house, what they're looking for is something big enough to have fun catching and throwing back if they can.
Catch and release.
It's catch and release. So that's the big thing. So now what we've got is we're looking at ways to improve the food supply for these bass so that they grow faster and they grow larger, okay? So back in the day, I can remember when you went to somebody's pond and one or two things, either all the bass were like 10 or 12 inches or everybody had caught all the bass out. Mm-hmm. And so there were hardly any bass in there. So now the thing is to try to keep that food supply coming and keep those bass growing at a very rapid rate. So we've looked at new things since 1952. Okay. We still like bluegill and bass because, as Toxie mentioned earlier, they spawn every month during the summer. And that's the best fish to put in to provide constant food for your bass population. But there's some new things that we've discovered back in the last 20 years. And that's threadfin shad. You look at any lake that produces big bass on a consistent basis, and I would say 90% of them have threadfin in there. Hmm. Okay, threadfin are a filter feeder. They feed off of the plankton population that's in your lake. If you fertilize your lake, it's ideal for threadfin. If your lake is really clear that you're letting your wife swim in, because you can see down to 8 or 10 feet, threadfin are not going to do well there because there's not enough food in there to keep that population going and keep them reproducing. So that's one of the keys to that. And the other keys are the fact that we've looked at beyond food. We've looked at just the same thing that we've done in a lot of other species, and that's look at genetics. Genetics is very important, but the limiting factor in all production is food supply. Food supply first, genetics second. So that's how we've improved these things, and we've managed these things now the way they wouldn't want you to manage back in the 50s and 60s. And that is we manage it so that the whole bluegill population, the whole lake population, is almost crowded bluegill. Hmm. We want lots and lots of bluegill in there. We don't necessarily want them to grow real big. You know, we're not looking for 1 pound bluegill in lakes that we're planning on producing big bass. We want lots of little 3 to 4 inch bluegill. So that's most of these bass can eat.
Is there anything you can plant in a pond that is beneficial for the fishery?
There are some things that you can plant, okay, but they don't really benefit the fishery all that much. Okay. For instance, if you wanted to improve your shellcracker fishing, like we talked about before, there could be some aquatic macrophytes you could plant in there. But the problem is trying to control those things so that they don't suck all the fertility out of your lake, and which they're known to do. That would improve the food supply for your shellcracker, but not necessarily for your bluegill. And there are other things that you can put in there that might be good cover for small fish. There's things that you can water willow, not common willows.
American water willow.
That's right. Exactly. Very good. And those things will provide some cover for the young of the year fish to get in. And that's beneficial in a way. But we're typically non-plant people. So So
well, you got to have cover, though. I mean,
you got to have cover, but you can put that in yourself with something that doesn't grow.
So I'm gonna name four things real quick, and you just tell me what you think about them as a forage. Fathead minnows.
Fathead minnows are excellent forage for the first year.
Yeah, so they're too slow. Is the only problem.
Okay,
they wipe them out.
So what happens typically is just like your uncle's lake that we just stocked fatheads in today. I said, guys, you got a lot of structure in here. You got some logs in here. Fathead minnows are different from a lot of other species because they spawn upside down. Hmm. Okay, people don't realize that, but they get on the underneath side of rocks and logs, and they have an adhesive egg, and they deposit that up under there. I said, when the end of April gets here, you go to your market, get you a couple of these waxed meat cartons that they put chicken steaks in, bring those back, cut them apart, lay them flat, put them in your lake. They'll float till the end of the summer. If you want to know if your fathead minnows are spawning, go lift one of those boxes up that's floating, and you'll see the eggs on the underneath side of that. Now, this is not necessarily for production of the fatheads because you've got plenty of structure in here for them to get up underneath, but, you know, it'd be hard for you to see that. But this lets you know that your fatheads are spawning. But I said, I'll tell you this, in most situations, by the end of October, all your fatheads are gone. Well, what happened to them? Bass ate every one of them. That's exactly what. And it increases your bass growth the first year. If you've got an established bass population and you're adding fathead minnows, you're just wasting your money.
They're just eating them as soon as you throw them out.
As soon as you put them in.
They're too slow. Yeah. They're just
They're slow and they're small and they don't spawn all that much. And the other part is that they're just, you know, most people don't realize how many pounds of fish it takes to produce a pound of bass. Okay. I do because Don and I ran a hatchery. You know, we had 1,000 pounds of broodfish. Okay. Males and females and northerns and Floridas. Okay, so we had to feed those things all year to keep them in good enough shape so when the spring came that they had produced a lot of eggs and were good producers. It takes at least 8 pounds of bluegill to produce 1 pound of bass.
Hmm.
So
that's a lot of little bluegill.
It's a lot of little bluegill. So if you feed it, whatever you feed them, if you were to feed them shiners or whatever, so you pay $5 a pound for shiners, that's a bargain. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Multiply that times 8.
Yeah.
You got $40 in a bass that weighs 1 pound.
Hmm.
What do you think you can sell that for? Not quite 40.
Mm-mm.
Maybe volume makes more money. I'm not sure. I'm not a good businessman.
I may not be like everybody else, but I'm not, you know, the bass thing is not really my thing. One, it's not my favorite fish to eat. I prefer brim and crappie and stuff like that. So are there any tips? I'd rather be hunting than catching a bass and throwing it back. That's just me. But
blasphemy.
Yeah, go ahead.
So
up,
what are some things you can do to improve your panfish?
There are two things
at your pond.
Right. There are two things you can do. Okay. Most important thing is to fertilize. Okay. The second most important thing in panfish is a feeder.
Okay.
Okay. Use a good quality feed. Don't go buy this adult catfish stuff to put out there, 30% protein. They make some good feed out there now that has a higher protein content. The bluegill like it, and they grow very fast on it. So if I had a pond I want to raise some big bluegill in, that would be one of the two things that I would recommend.
So let's pretend like Dudley didn't ask that question. So if I ask you about fatheads, what about crawfish, stocking crawfish in a pond, in a bass pond?
Well, as you know, bass love crawfish. And you can buy this stuff by the sack. You know, you can put hundreds of pounds in there. But if you take a crawfish out and you take a bluegill and you hold them side by side in your hands, okay? The crawfish has about 60 to 80% chitin, okay? That's an indigestible material. that the bass gets nothing from when he eats that crawfish.
Okay.
Compared to a bluegill, which is a nice succulent little meal for a bass. Mm-hmm. So I think you're better off to take the money that you would have used for crawfish and turn around and buy intermediate bluegill and put it in your pond if your bass need food.
What about tilapia? I hear a lot of people.
Tilapia works well. That's those things spawn quite often, and the one added thing about tilapia is that during the summer and the time that they're spawning, that the females are actually keep the fry inside their mouth.
Hmm. Wow!
So they suck water in to feed the fry, but they keep those fry inside there so that they're not consumed by something like green sunfish or a really big bluegill or something else that could eat those, you know, and they're not available to small bass typically because they're guarded by that tilapia female. And then in the fall, when the temperatures start dropping, these tilapia become slower than fathead minnows. And so the bass are able to come in and a fish that's probably 4 inches in size or maybe 5 or 3 to 5 and catch those things really rapidly. And then they're able to put on a lot of weight. So that's one of the advantages of having tilapia in your pond. Some states don't allow tilapia, so you need to check your regulations to make sure that it's illegal to put those in. But it's just like all of us that are sitting here, okay? If you want to lose weight, don't eat you a bunch of hamburgers and go sit on the couch. Okay? Same thing applies to your fish. You know, you want the fish, the bass, the predator, to be as efficient as it can be in consuming a bait. Don't just put one bluegill or one tilapia out there for him to chase all around the lake to try to eat. Get a bunch of them and make sure he can capture those without expending too much energy.
Okay.
That makes sense.
It seems to have been, we've tried most of that. It seems, you know, without going back and shocking and actually physically surveying, it just seems like the threadfin shad have worked the best. And we actually see survival over time with the right cover more than other stuff. You know, I mean, the bream is the king. But as far as incremental of that, it seems like, to me at least, we've had the best luck with the threadfin shad.
Absolutely. I agree with that completely. And if you put tilapia in there, they're going to winter kill. So you have to stock them again the following year.
Okay.
If you stock shad in there, in most climates, they're going to last for at least 5 years before you have before your pond ices over to the point that these things will die.
So you make a good point. I remember we had a guest one time that talked about managing some ponds, and they had no structure in them, and those bass would like just swim loops.
Just cruise all the time.
And exercise.
Yeah.
But once they put structure out in the lake and then they just parked by that structure, they were able to start putting some weight on them.
That's true. And they're just sitting there waiting for something that they can eat to come by. Rather than cruising the whole lake. So, you know, structure is very important.
Well, the other thing is your bait fish can't survive if there's no structure. They're going to wipe it out, and then there's famine somewhere. And famine sets in the kingdom.
So help our listeners understand. So some guys in Minnesota listening to this, they really don't need to be worried about fertilizing their pond. And where does that line kind of break? It seems like it's a southeastern thing, Texas over.
It's pretty much southeastern and east Texas. There are some places in Texas where fertilization is not effective. Okay, where they've got enough hardness in there and enough they grow enough plankton naturally in there that they don't need to do that. You know, so your guys up there in Minnesota, that typically is not an area that you would consider fertilizing your pond. And then they can grow some pretty good fish in those areas because they have a lot of natural nutrients there in those lakes.
Remember, Bobby and I worked a trade show one time with there was extension agents from all over the country. And we had set up our booth and had our fish pond fertilizer sitting out. And like the ones that weren't in the southeast, they saw this pond fertilizer, and they were like, "What are you doing?" they didn't even know about.
That's right. Yeah, they're not aware of that. And then the other part, there's another segment out there, and a lot of these people are in the Midwest and North area, and there where they don't want to add any nutrients to the.
Yeah, they don't want to add like phosphates.
That's right.
But that would be like more in a river system, not a closed system. That's a pond.
Yeah. So anyway, there. In a lot of our worlds here, it's certainly advantageous to fertilize if you've got your water quality right, just like liming.
What is that pH supposed to be, 7 or?
The pH varies. See, a lot of people look at that as an indicator of whether they need to lime or not. Mm-hmm. But actually, that pH fluctuates during the day as a diurnal fluctuation. So you start out in the morning, your pH is a little lower, and then as you develop through the day, if you've got any plankton in there at all, the pH rises. So if somebody says, "Oh, well, this is my pond, and this is the pH, what do you think?" I said, "Well, I don't know what to tell you. What time of day did you take this sample?" That's a big part of what's going on there. So total alkalinity is what we like to look at.
Gotcha.
And if that's low, typically, you know, this is an arbitrary threshold, but we usually use 20 parts per million. Okay. If it's below 20, it can benefit from lime in your lake. If it's above that, you don't need to worry about it. It's so just like your uncle's lake down there, Toxie.
Yeah.
I took water samples on that, and theirs were 40 parts per million because they've got some lime in that area down there. And they don't need any lime in that pond, although they did add some to it.
So I remember it's a long time ago you were stocking one, and you had it's like a big test tube with a dropper. Yeah,
that's right.
And he was dropping, and I was like, "What do we got here? What's it going to be like?" And he was dropping, and he kept looking at it and dropping, and then finally he just threw the whole thing of water out. He said, "Don't worry about it. You're not going to have a problem."
That's right.
So evidently it was really high.
It was really high. And I recall that. But a lot of times in a lot of the lakes that we look at, you know, we take that same test tube full of water. We put some chemicals in there so that when we titrate that with an acid. And a lot of times you'll add one drop or two. Bingo. It turns color. Mm-hmm. And that indicates that your alkalinity is probably 5 to 10. Really low, and so that really benefits from adding some lime to that.
I guarantee you, I'm gonna have to put some lime in.
Yeah. Alkalinity versus pH it's hard to figure out in the brain. Yeah.
That's right. That's
but
right.
It's 20 parts per million is the alkalinity. Threshold you're looking at.
That's right, alkalinity, and you know you and the opposite part of that is you know we look at some lakes that may be over some coastal lakes, for instance. And you take the pH of that, my bluegill ain't spawning. I said, "Well, what kind of water quality you got?" "I don't know. It looks pretty good to me."
But, you know, that sounds like
100%, because it does look pretty good to me.
Right. So you run the pH on that, and it ends up being 4. Well, you're not going to get much plankton production, and then you got some other things that are affected by a low pH like that. For instance, bluegill reproduction and bass reproduction. So, you know, so you test your pH and your alkalinity, but the pH is not the key factor.
Could I just take like a pool test strip?
You can
stick her in there.
You can. All right. You can.
All right.
You got one of those.
I got some of those.
Hey, that's close enough for government work.
Yeah. All right. Good.
Yeah, I know alkalinity is important when you're growing crops, like at our nursery.
Oh right. Yeah.
Oh yeah.
Absolutely. We like to stay below 100.
Yeah.
So quickly, can you kind of tell us a little bit about your thoughts on northern black bass and Florida bass? What you would recommend stocking, or a hybrid of those, or what do you love to see?
Well, northern bass were native to most of Mississippi and Alabama. There was some influence down in South Alabama with some Florida genetics that came up, you know, out of North Florida, that area there, but there have been a lot of studies done on these. I mean, recently. When I say recently, I mean in the last 20 years, okay? And so one of the things that was discovered was that the northern bass are much more aggressive than Florida bass. and so forth, they're much easier to catch. Hmm. So one of the things that we did at the hatchery was to develop a fish that was a cross between a fast-growing Florida fish and a fast-growing Northern, okay? And the reason we got onto this thing, because when we first started, we grew all Floridas because we wanted our clients to grow some big fish, you know, and have maybe a 10 or 12 or 14 pounder or bigger in there.
Well, Clyde wanted a big fish.
Yeah, right. Clyde right. wanted good.
So Clyde wanted that. So we get a call, you know, one time down in South Alabama, and they said, look, I think we need to restock this lake with some bass. I said, well, what's the problem, Clyde? He said, well, we can't catch any of them. I said, well, are you sure they're not in there? Well, look, me and Leroy, we can't. We're as good as there is, okay? We ain't caught nothing. So I said, well, I'll tell you what to do. Let's just bring our shocking boat down there, okay? And we'll put it in and see what you've got. Maybe you don't have any bass. I don't know. I've never fished there. So we bring the shocking boat down and put it in. Well, they got everybody's a member was there. You know? And so they're all huddled around the bank and in the boats out there. I said, look, just don't get in the electrodes, you know, try not to pick up anything that's in front of the boat.
Yeah, they won't do it but once.
That's right. So anyway, we get out there and start shocking. Well, we hadn't shocked 5 minutes. We turned the water white with fish that were about 7 to 10 and 11 pounds.
They ain't as good as they thought they were.
No, they weren't. And so it ended up, as we looked at the records for this thing, this was stocked a number of years ago by the state at that particular time. All they stocked was Florida bass. Hmm. So they were all Florida bass. And so Don and I went back home. We said, look, we can't develop this kind of fishery for these people. We need to do something that's different. So we got to talking about it for a little bit, and I said, you know, back in the day, you know, you started with the state, and I did too. We started a little program where we did Floridas and Northerns, and we combined those two and had a hybrid between the two. And we looked at the growth on these things and discovered that the hybrid actually was a faster-growing fish than either of the parents were. Hmm. So we started developing a program where we were selecting what kind of brood fish we had and making these hybrids. And originally we called them F1s. You know, well, everybody had F1. So we had a lake that we had stocked from the origin, and we had a bunch of people from Bass over that we let them fish in there. And we had Tom Mann come up. He said, man, these things are the toughest fish I've caught, bass. He said, you don't need to call these F1s. These are like tigers. Hmm. So Tom contributed to the fact that we call these fish tiger bass.
Tiger bass.
Yeah, that's how they got its name. Wasn't because I was clever enough to think of it, or Don either, bless our hearts, but, you know.
Heterosis, hybrid vigor.
There you go. Yeah.
So was it a boy Northern and a female Florida, or the opposite?
It was that. A boy Northern and a female Florida. Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
And you found something different if you flipped that?
Probably. We didn't do much of that flipping because
it worked.
So what we did worked, and we thought that was the best. We thought that would be the best thing to have that good growth potential in it. And so they're still producing those at American Sportfish now. So
on average, if a guy stocks the right fish, has the right feeder fish program, follows what you recommend, right, what kind of weight can he put on a bass every – what can he expect a two-year-old fish to weigh?
4 pounds.
Hmm.
We've seen these tiger bass grow from 2 inches to 2 pounds – 6 months.
Wow.
Yep.
October.
So when the lake at our place down there, we all fished the Smuggler Lake.
Yeah, it's awesome.
And we did it the first time. The cormorants destroyed it. We started over. And we did his formula. And for a fact, I mean, you stocked them in June.
Right.
And so they were actually would be, you know, a year old maybe in April. Or May.
That's right.
Yeah. So, but you stocked them in June. So anyway, I remember one of Neil's friends caught, and we waited. It was just an ounce under 9 pounds, and that fish was not quite 3 years old.
Wow.
And I saw it from my eyes, and there's no other fish could have been in there. We drained and started over. So that's what could – I know that's probably a little extraordinary, but I know you've seen that before too. It can happen. And the main thing I just tell everybody, I said, get – I mean, look, use him. If not, get – there are some great people, you know. But go by what they tell you. Use that formula, like we've talked most of it today, and you can do that everywhere.
You can. And it's amazing how rapidly these things can grow. So like I said, food supply is critical. So you've got to develop that to begin with, and that all goes back to your original stocking, okay? The way you stock it and what proportion of bluegill to bass you put in. To give you an example, in 1950, you know, they stocked 1,000 bluegill and 100 bass. And so that's kind of been a standard for a number of years. Well, just that typically gets you into, with not much harvest, gets you into a crowded bass situation where your bass quit growing after about 2 years. The growth slows down. But if you stock it another way, the way we do, the way we did stocksies, then your bass growth increases each year. And it's not uncommon. It's a pretty common thing to get experience 2 years, 2 pounds per year growth out of these bass.
Lanny, I'm thinking in about 3 years, I want to come over there.
I can promise you, our biggest pond we own. We completed. What happened to us was the Nutria destroyed that dam.
The levee.
Destroyed it. Swiss cheesed 500 yards of levee.
Wow.
Just destroyed it. There was no answer, but, you know, and these are the dirt guys, but they know Greg Briggs and company. They know what they're doing. It's like you have, boss, you have no option but to start completely over. So they drained it, let it completely dry up, dug it all the way out below there. And, you know, the one thing that I talked about, the Oxbow type lake, there's a guy down in Scuba who's just brilliant. David Bryan's built most of our stuff, all of our stuff down there. Mm-hmm. And he put, and I'd forgotten about it till Greg reminded me. He put bull panel all the way across the dam, just maybe you can put like 6 inches of dirt over, but he put it all the way across the dam of the one, the Oxbow Lake that was near the river. Because he said, look, you're going to have, they're going to get eaten alive by beaver. It'll stop them. Watch. We've never had a problem with beavers or nutrias there. I did not do it on the other one. Wasn't thinking, didn't know. But this time we did. We had a bunch of hog wire and stuff too. Left over from something. And so we put wire all the way across. I think it'll stop them, but it's amazing. I had to start completely over. Point in saying that, Bobby, is he just got through putting his finishing touches on it last summer. And so you won't even have to wait 3 years. You could probably do it this summer.
Oh, wow.
Catch up 2 and 3s this summer.
So I've got everybody's probably got some more questions, but there's two things I want to make sure we touch on. How bad of a problem are otters? It seemed like I've heard you whisper in my ear that if you're trying to grow a big bass, you need to make sure you're careful about those otters.
Otters are really, really top of the line predators. Okay. Usually they work together in a group. Okay. So they'll come into a lake. And they'll herd these fish up just like shepherd dogs on cattle. And they'll push them all up into an area, a pocket or some place in there where they can catch these things. And believe me, cause I had them at the hatchery there when we ran that thing. They'll catch and kill the biggest bass you've got in there.
Hmm.
There's been some data generated on these things that these things could eat if it was available to them, you know, more than 10 pounds of fish a day. So you get your 6 or 8 otters in there that just came in from the river. They think they're in downtown at a smorgasbord.
Mm, yeah.
And they're going to stay there until the fishing gets bad for them.
That's a lot of pounds per day.
It is. It is. Now, that's under ideal conditions, but still, that's the potential these things have.
So guys need to be aware of that and just watch for the runs and stuff. And
Watch in the wintertime for runs on the backside of your dam and for scat. You know, you see some little piles of droppings there that all have scales in them. The bigger the scales, the bigger the fish. So,
yeah, Mr. Barry, could you give us an idea of, you know, traditional stocking rates for bass versus bream on a pond?
Yeah, back in the day when they were developing this for primarily for protein, okay, a source of protein for farmers who had a pond on their place to supplement what they could get off of their farm, then that rate was about 1,000 bluegill fingerlings followed by 100 bass fingerlings. So the bluegill were stocked in the winter, and the bass were stocked in.
And that's per acre. June.
That's per acre.
Gotcha. Right.
Nowadays, if we want to develop specialty fisheries, for instance, you got a lake and you want stocked, and you want to develop a bass fishery in there. Mm-hmm. Okay. So we'll go and raise the rate of the bluegill by 10 times.
Uh-huh.
We want to change that stocking ratio from a 10 to 1 to much increased. So we might come in and stock in 2,000 or even 5,000 bluegill per acre. Hmm. And then follow that by, depending on how fertile your lake is going to be, by the maximum would be 100, but most of the time it would be 50 to 75 bass fingerlings per acre. Hmm. And so that creates big, big food supply and has these bass growing off at a really, really fast rate.
Rapid growth.
Right.
Makes sense.
Yeah.
I can't remember. Did you put any threadfin shad? I know we always do fatheads with the brim.
We did fathead with the brim, and then we followed that up with some threadfin shad.
Okay.
Yep. Yeah.
Mackie, you had a question about something you've heard about all your life in Columbus. What was that?
Yeah, so there's a creek, Miss Berry, called the Luxapalala, and I've always heard that there's walleye in there, but I never hear about anybody catching walleye. Do you have any experience with that?
Well, we do, because in Alabama, for instance, we've got walleye that are native to the Coosa River system. They go all the way up and into Georgia, yeah, all the way down to Mobile. And so it's not unheard of to see and run into a few people who are walleye fishermen. For instance, right there at Montgomery, Bobby, where you grew up, the Tallapoosa had good walleye fishing in it. I mean, I caught one out of there that weighed 8 pounds, eight and a half pounds.
Did you eat that skillet up?
Yes, sir.
I turned him loose because I caught him in a gill net.
Oops.
In spite of what Bobby says, I'm not that great a fisherman. Anyway, but also I saw Danny Foster catch one that was 8 pounds out of the Tallapoosa River. We were up there fishing for stripers, and he caught a big walleye. And so it wasn't unusual to have somebody who fished during the time of the year of typically February, you know, late January, February, depending on the weather was, to, and on through the late spring to catch walleye in the Tallapoosa with a crawfish-colored crankbait. Hmm. I mean, people with some of those deep holes, and I've caught a few myself, but none 8 pounds.
Yeah.
But it's not unusual to catch a 2 to 3 pounder, or maybe a 4 pounder in there. And these are distributed all the way down the river systems to Mobile. But nobody knows how to fish for them, you know, and so you seldom ever have any caught. And the same thing, we started putting walleye in some of our state-owned and managed public fishing lakes, and these were anywhere from 25 or 30 acres to 100 and something acres in size, and we stocked enough in there we could follow them with our sampling techniques to know that they were growing and doing well. Hardly anybody ever caught one. So basically, we looked at it from the standpoint of managing that lake, that it was a waste of time and energy and money to put those in there because nobody knew how to catch them.
Yeah, put some walleye in.
I was going to say,
good to eat that.
Yeah, they're as good as there is.
I'm fishing for food.
I'd let you teach me how to catch them if I could grow them.
Barry, so when you're sitting here, you know so much, and every time you say something, I jot down another question I want to ask.
That's right.
But can you? I want to make sure we cover the big things. I see now, you know, our friend Jeff Foxworthy's got these really neat bubbling look things that are bubbling up in his lake. Old Waverly, they've got some out there.
Right.
Can you talk about stratifying the water and what's going on and why you need these kind of things?
Yeah, those little bubbler things are called bottom diffusers. Okay, and they operate because they have something that's we placed on the bottom that you can take compressed air from just a regular compressor, a one horse compressor, and through tubing run through this little diffuser that sits on the bottom of that thing. And as these bubbles come up to the top, a couple of things happen. Okay. One is that if it's not already saturated with oxygen, it can add atmospheric oxygen to the water. Okay. Which would increase the amount of oxygen you have in that water column. The other thing is that as these bubbles float to the surface, with them, they drag the water from the bottom up to the top.
Hmm.
So that bubble curtain does two things. It moves that water and keeps it from stratifying. And stratification means that it just layers, okay? Any of you guys remember learn how to swim in a foreign pond? Mm-hmm. You know, you stripped off and
it gets cold down there.
That's right. Yeah. That's exactly right.
We loved it.
Yeah. So you go out in there and suddenly you feel that cold water on your lower leg or your foot. And so that's, you have just penetrated the thermocline or where that pond stratifies. And that bottom layer in there that's cold over a period of time loses all of its oxygen. So you've got a pond out there that may be 10 or 12 feet deep. And if you've got any color on that pond during the summer, it actually shades out the bottom and all of your oxygen level is at the top from above the thermocline. This bubbler keeps that water turning. So if you look at it like this, suppose you got a 2 or 3 story apartment and you got a bunch of people that have moved in there to live. Okay. In the summertime, a pond like that stratifies, it's just like moving everybody to the upper floor. So all your fish are crowded up there. So if you fish, I'm down here fishing this deep hole. Well, you just
he is
wasting your time.
You know? Sounds like Carl from Sling Blade.
Because there are no fish down there. There's no oxygen for them to. So when you destratify that thing and keep the water moving in there, it allows both your food, this includes your insects and things, to live on the bottom all the way to the top. And this spreads your fish out so they're not crowded either. So you get more food production and all your fish are healthier if you keep that water rolling in there and keep it turning so that it does not stratify.
Isn't that a great insurance policy to keep it from flipping too?
It is. It's a good insurance policy to keep it from flipping. But now let me give you a little warning here. And I've seen this happen a lot of times. Yeah, old Clyde, he was going to destratify his own pond. So, yeah, me and old Leroy put this thing in here in July the 4th. Okay, well, the pond was already stratified. So what they did is they just mixed up all that dead water from the bottom with what was up top.
They flipped it for themselves.
They flipped it for themselves, and they killed all their fish in there. Don't do that. So if you're going to start with these things, you need to start in the spring. Okay, and then gradually start. Don't just turn it on full force. Just gradually start moving that water around and let everything destratify and equalize.
And so I guess when we ride by the catfish ponds and see them running those big paddles, they're doing the same thing, but even at a higher volume of movement.
Yeah, very similar. But a lot of those ponds can destratify, but typically they're shallow enough that they're just adding oxygen to that. So to keep those things, for catfish, from dying from oxygen deprivation.
Yeah.
So
go ahead, Mac. All right, Mr. Berry, I got a question for you. Mm-hmm. So when we're talking about the size of a pond in acres,
right?
But we're not talking about the depth of the pond. That's so, right. I mean, you can have a 5-acre pond that's 2 feet deep.
Yeah.
Or a 2-acre pond that's 20 feet deep.
Right.
So the water is obviously a lot greater in the deeper of the pond. So would that cause you to have to use more fertilizer based on the deepest parts of your pond?
Like from a volume
of water. Your overall size of your pond's way bigger the deeper it is.
That's true. But most of your fertility is in the upper layer of that water because it only goes down as deep as you get sunlight penetration. Okay. So that helps produce your plankton, which helps produce your food supply. So if the pond that's 20 feet deep is stratified, you got nothing on the bottom in there growing. I mean, there's no oxygen down there. So you don't have any plankton, you don't have any insects except anaerobic stuff and no other food or fish down there. So just as a kind of a happy medium, we base our fertility on surface acres and on the visibility that we get off of that. So if you got a good bloom in there and your visibility is 20 to 24 inches, you're good to go.
So let me kind of circle back here. This is one of the things I wanted to ask you. Many, many years ago, you helped us get our magazine Farming for Wildlife started that morphed into Gamekeepers.
Right.
In the early days, you wrote several articles about all female bass ponds that you were experimenting with, and it sounded really exciting. There's actually the Mossy Oak Golf Course. We stocked it. You guys stocked it that way, and they've caught some big fish. What's the latest in that? Is that would you say that's been a success, or were there challenges with that y'all didn't anticipate?
Well, there's some challenges with that. I mean, for instance, one of the first lakes that we stocked with all females that was of any size was about a 25-acre lake, and it was owned by a doctor, okay, in Montgomery. And it's not to say anything derogatory about doctors and fishing, but, you know, he called in about, I mean, we talked to him every year. We went out and sampled the fish. You know, every spring we sampled them with electrofishing and recorded our data and could see that these things were growing and everything was looking good out there. But he called in and said, look, I don't really like this thing. I said, well, why not? You know, you were there. You saw the fish that we got out of there when we sampled it. He said, yeah, but, you know, I can't catch any of them. And I said, well, these are F1s. You should be able to catch them. I don't understand. Well, I don't think there's enough of them in here. I said, I'll tell you what, let's go back and take a look at that and see. So this was one of the drawbacks to having this all-female lake is that we were looking for developing really fast-growing fish and some large trophy bass, which we did in that particular lake. And the problem was that he was not a really good fisherman. You know, he was kind of like Bobby Bass.
Mm-hmm. So thank you for saying that. Oh, yeah.
So anyway, he was trying to go out and, you know, and flip a plastic worm up on the bank and pull it off and whatever. And so his kids fished out there, and they weren't any better than he was, of course, because he's the one that taught them how to fish. And so they couldn't catch very many of them. And so that was disappointing. And so we had to kind of work this thing a little bit where we maybe increase the stocking rate a little bit from what we stocked to his was like 30 or 35 per acre. And since these were females, they were already adults, and we had let this lake go a year building up forage before we put any bass in there. So the growth rate was really exceptional in there. So we came back every year and added a few, but what we really needed to do was maybe tailor this to the individual, because everybody's not a trophy bass fisherman. Now, I took a buddy of mine over there who's a really good fisherman. He was a tournament fisherman, and he was a trophy bass fisherman. And so, he thought he had died and gone to heaven. He and I fished together for like 4 hours, and we caught 25 bass that were over 6 pounds. And, you know, he thought he had died and gone to heaven. That was really good. But these guys were disappointed because we caught more fish than they had caught in a whole year.
I think it's probably safe to say that that is still a strategy, but for the guy who wants to grow the single biggest fish, maybe not to go catch a lot all the time necessarily. Right. Y'all were able to do it, but you probably the first of those techniques that fish had seen when y'all went there too. So, you know, I can see where I would be a drawback to the average recreational fisherman that loves to catch them. And look, you can still grow really big fish. But, you know, if a guy like wants to, you know, ensure he catches a 15 pounder or some crazy number, he's looking for the single biggest fish he can grow. That's probably the best way to do it.
That's the best way to do it for several reasons. And it can actually be an advantage to some guy who's just likes to catch decent sized fish. Okay. The big advantage to this is that all females have the potential to be trophies. Males typically top out at about 4 pounds. You'll see, I've seen some, but I've seen lots and lots of bass. I've seen some that are 6.5 pounds that were males. That's the exception. So most of these things will top out at probably 3 to 4 pounds as a male. But so to grow that 3 to 4 pound fish, he's just as much food, you know, to begin with, as does a female. The other advantage of this is that you have, if you've got an all-female lake, you have no reproduction. There's no obligation for you to continue to take fish out 20 pounds per acre or something out of your lake in order to keep the best that are in there growing very rapidly. So that's the big advantage, is you don't have to harvest. You can just catch them and throw them back if you want to. And everything's fine. But you go into another type of lake, you know, like Dudley's, and you know, and you may be required, you may need to take some bass out. So then that puts a little extra pressure on you. You know, well, and typically what we see is, well, we didn't catch but about 4 or 5. Let's just turn them loose. You know, and then you keep building up all these small bass, and then the next thing you know, you really have run out of food. It's kind of like a, you know, you can only have so many cattle on the pasture.
Well, you're probably more likely to catch the same fish again, or present a lure to a fish that's been caught before and all that, because, you know, you've got less. If you fish it, seems like you'd probably be conscious not to fish it too hard, which actually leads me to a question I was thinking about, Bobby, that I think a lot of people, I'd love to know, just a general opinion. I know it's not perfect science, but we've talked to Kevin Van Dam and Hank Parker and Bill Dance and, you know, some of our Mossy Oak fishing people about, you know, fishing pressure. And when you catch a fish, how is it effective? How long would you wait for you catch that fish again? Or like if you had a bunch of people coming to fish for a weekend, did you need to leave it alone for a while? Or did it even matter? What's your opinion on the fishing pressure and how it affects fishing?
I think it matters, okay? And I've seen this in a number of situations. So if you go out and you put a lot of pressure on these fish and you catch some and you throw them all back, you know, that some of those fish will hit again right away. But after a while, some of them get to where they don't want to hit and they don't want to feed because they've just learned that that's not the thing to do. So fishing pressure can be handled in a number of different ways. But if you harvest the proper size out of there, that helps a little bit, okay? But then if you some of these lakes that we've managed actually had clients that wanted us to come in and harvest them with electric fishing so that we could take out the numbers that needed to take out.
Without making them look
without stretching their lips too much so they don't want to bite again. But, yeah, that's a real problem. And for these lakes, they have a lot of pressure in them.
So I need to keep Bobby out of there more is what you're saying.
Barry, you're not helping me out of there. First, you hurt me a minute ago. Now you hurt me again.
I knew we needed to put a collar on him.
So, look, we've been at this a while. I think we could sit here and we need to do this again. You've been very educational. I've learned a lot. I try to write down a couple of things that I learn every time, and I'm at 6 already, and that's more than I've ever written down on a podcast before.
So. I didn't know you could count that high.
Yeah.
Really?
Got on to another hand. So, Mac, why don't we've got a trivia question prepared for you, Barry.
Today's trivia is brought to you by Sheffield Financial. Explore swift, effortless, and convenient financing for power sports, outdoor power equipment, and trailers, fueling your pursuits in hunting, fishing, and gamekeeping. More details at SheffieldFinancial.com.
Yeah, we love Sheffield. They help us out a bunch. And so, Barry, the way this thing works is Mac – I'm probably taking Mac's spot here, but our listener has already won a prize. You're playing for a prize for you and for – I'm going to go ahead and say Carol could win one too. We'll send two podcast T-shirts home with you.
Wow.
So, Mac, why don't you take it from here?
All right, Mr. Barry. So our podcast listener that left us a review is HZZHHSBSH that left us a review. Thank you for the review. So you're going to win two houndstooth turkey calls, and we'll send them to you.
You know, what does that name mean? Does it mean anything, Mike? Is that code for something?
Not that I know of.
Okay, I was hoping it would.
I figured you were hoping it was. All right, Mr. Barry, so the question for you is, How many species of black bass are in the state of Alabama, which I would assume are in the southeast?
Okay, we've just got a new black bass that's named. Okay, so that adds another thing to it. We have a largemouth. We have the spotted bass. We have the coosa bass. And over in East Alabama, there's also a shoal bass and a smallmouth, which is really restricted to the Tennessee River.
Yeah, I thought we might sneak that smallmouth one in there on it. But.
Yeah, that was silly. I mean, the people that published that will call him to find out what the heck is the number. So that wasn't too difficult.
That's okay. I hope I passed without Don here to give me some coaching.
Yeah, so you get two podcast T-shirts to take back home.
So. Wow, cool. Yeah. Carol be thrilled.
Well, yeah, that's worth a 8-hour drive. Yeah, you bet.
Sure. For sure. So. What should we be asking you?
That's a good question to ask that question. What are the most common mistakes?
It is. Well, I think we've covered most of them. You know, one thing is people disregard the actual impact that stocking has in a new lake. Okay. Now I'm going to get a leader over to bring me some bass. I'll catch some bluegill out of my other pond and put it in here. It's just a big mistake. I mean, you can ruin a pond from the beginning by, for instance, just trying to save some money and stocking some adult bass in there, okay? Because, first of all, you don't know what strain they are. That can be important. But secondly is that you can't control the numbers once they spawn. You know, I'm going to tell Toxie I'm going to stock 50 per acre in his new lake. So you put one pair of bass in there, you could end up with 500 per acre. And then they don't grow off.
That's right.
These bass ain't growing. Well, they don't have enough to eat. You know, you got too many of them in there to begin with. So that's one of the first things. And then stocking any other fish from the river in there is a big mistake. And so, you know, whether you got somebody that wants to put some crappie in there or whatever, or sometimes they'll just think they're helping you out.
I see a lot of similarities, you know, in food plotting and stuff like, you know, establishing native grasses and wildflowers.
Right, exactly.
You spend all this time and money building a pond.
Yeah.
You know, do it right the first time.
Really?
You know, adding the fish is a much lesser expense than building a dam.
It is.
A complete parallel to deer, especially. And we've learned that you can't just have a place with deer and all of a sudden plant a bunch of great food plots and supplemental feed them. And boom, that summer they put on these great horns. I mean, if they're really going to express something exceptional, they have to be healthy and nutritionally taken care of from the time they're born.
That's right.
And you're telling us the same thing about fish. If That's you right. ever start out wrong, I mean, I still remember you saying too, I mean, this is another piece of advice that when you do stock, if you can kind of catch some that first year, if you can kind of keep up with those first fish that you stocked and be sure they go back because they got more at a young age than you'll ever get from the rest of them. And you're probably going to catch your biggest fish by one of those growing up simply because they had all that perfect nutrition as a child, so to speak, or a fingerling. And you can't just throw a bunch of nutrition in a pond at a later date and do any good to speak of. Not like that. So that's the parallel I see between that and deer. Very, very similar to growing a trophy.
Yeah.
It starts when they're born.
And actually, Toxie, I owe you an apology.
What's that?
Well, I didn't think you were paying attention to anything I told you back in the day.
You know, paying attention, I did. Adhering to it, the discipline, sometimes I don't.
Oh, my goodness. I tell you what, I've enjoyed having Barry and Clyde here today.
Oh, yeah.
Well, we get Clyde. So.
Well, we're just glad to be here, too.
I wonder if he does that and uses Bobby for the name when he's in another place.
He probably calls our office and acts like Clyde.
Barry, you got a son, you got some grandchildren.
Nothing like it.
Yeah,
like
boy, they, you know, what a great grandfather they've got to take them fishing and hunting and all that.
Yeah. That's true. Don't get me started on that because, you know, we don't have time all these kids nowadays. Well, we're playing. Well, we start baseball. Yep. What we just got through is basketball. Well, we got, you know,
soccer.
Yeah. Well, we got all these things. It's a lot more complicated than it was when I was growing up.
Yeah, we just went fishing.
Yeah. Yeah. Life's busy, Barry. But I tell you what, I've always been impressed with the way you conduct your business and the way you handle yourself. You're just you're a good guy. And we're
the best.
We're blessed to have known you.
Well, I'm blessed to have known you guys too. So this is good. I appreciate it. I appreciate all the flattery for, you know, trying to get me to come
Bobby,
back.
And Bobby's trying to get into one of your ponds. I know. You ought to see him work a guy over's got a really good turkey lease.
Lord have mercy, Barry. You see what I have to put up with?
I do, Bobby.
Dudley, you got anything else we need to ask?
I had one question, and I'm sure folks ask you this. What's like the smallest pond you would recommend for, you know, to get the full experience?
That's a good question, Dudley.
That is a good question, Dudley. And normally we look at it this way, okay? If you've got something that's going to be larger than a half acre, okay, you can support a bluegill and bass pond. If it's smaller than that, then I would probably steer you in another direction because it's hard enough to keep the balance going on in that pond between the number, the ratios of the bass and the bluegill, keeping everything healthy and reproducing and growing at a good rate. If you get smaller than a half acre, it's really difficult to do.
Okay, good to know.
Mac, you got anything else you want to ask? You're good. Rob, wake up over there. I tell you, this has been really, you know, we talk fish ponds occasionally, right. And I tell you, I just find it fascinating.
Well, we all love this topic. I love this topic. But I'll say I'm guessing Bobby loves this topic more than anybody at Mossy Oak Biology. He absolutely adores fishing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and I tell you what, fishing with Barry is so educated. I've been blessed to go with him. And he's teaching, just like he is now, he's teaching the whole time that he's not fussing at you about something. So.
Well, we probably need a little fussing.
Yeah. Buddy, if you had learned to cast at least as good as your daughter, you'd be okay.
There we go. I get that a lot. So I tell you one last thing, because I asked you to do this. Have you got a good fish story you could tell us real quick?
I got a good turkey story.
Well, I do.
Even better.
Yeah.
Even better. I mean, this is the time of the year to think about all those things, but you remember a guy that worked for the Department of Conservation, Game and Fish, named Paul Maddox?
I do, yes.
Okay, well, Paul was regarded as probably one of the top turkey hunters in the whole division, okay? And he worked for the director, Charles Kelly, worked directly under him. And so he did whatever Charles needed him to do. But during the turkey season, you couldn't find him because he was in the woods every day. Just like Toxie. Okay. So, but part of his job was to carry these people that Charles, his boss, thought would be influential to help the department out. And so he harvested his limit every year, but then you could add another dozen or more on top of that for who he called in birds for other people. So when I first started turkey hunting, I was a young guy there in the department, and I'd never been before that year, so I went out and I harvested my first turkey, okay? And I think that was one of those turkeys, as we all know, that we've hunted enough, that were just very suicidal in tendencies. He just came up by himself, really, and I harvested him. But I didn't have anybody, any mentor, to tell you that. A lot of people would talk to me, but I never had anybody to carry me hunting. So Paul, one day, he said, look, boy, I'm gonna take you out myself, okay? And, man, I was so excited. And so he says, I said, well, what time we have to get up? Oh, I'm not taking you in the morning now. I'm going to do that. But I'll take you tomorrow. Just be ready to go by lunchtime. I said, lunch? Hey, you call up a turkey at lunch? He said, oh, yeah, we can do that. So anyway, we met there at lunch, and it was a place down in Wilcox County. Had a lot of turkeys, you know, Pine Barren Creek kind of bordered part of the property down there. And so anyway, we went, and we kept walking, and finally we got to this place. There was this big, big, huge pine tree. He said, yeah, I think this is far enough. So we sat down there, and he said, "Now look, you know I ain't got but one eye." I said, "Yeah, I understand. Well, I got to sit on this side over here so I can see." I said, "Okay." So anyway, he said, "Now, if we hear a bird gobble, pretty good chances I'm going to call him up. We'll kill him." I said, "All right." So he started off, you know, a little three-yelp soft thing, a little five-yelp, pretty soft. Nothing, I thought. This is exactly, maybe this is like snipe hunting. I don't know. I mean, maybe he just lured me into this thing. And so he, you know, Paul used a Lohmann box. All you old timers know what that is. Mm-hmm. Toxic too. But he had him a little special cedar striker. Lohmann box comes with a solid piece of cedar that you strike on that thing. But this was a box. So it was a box on a box. And so he got on that thing. And I mean, he started talking turkey with the thing, and it carried all the way down to Pine Level Creek. Well, sure enough, before he even finished that series, everyone gobbled way down in there, you know. He said, "There he is." I said, "Yeah, I heard him." He said, "Well, we're just going to wait here just a minute or two, and then we're going to call again." So he waited about, it seemed to me like 30 minutes, but it probably was just five. And so he got down on that box again, and before he finished that call, that turkey gobble, he said, "He's coming. He's coming. He's a lot closer." He said, now you get ready. Get your gun up. He's going, there's a little, not a creek, but it's a little wet weather thing down there. He's going to come around the end of that thing. He's come on your side. That's why I put you over there." I said, "Okay, I appreciate that, Paul. Great. This is great. I'm so excited." So anyway, he starts calling. You could hear the bird coming. You know, he was getting closer and closer and closer. And then finally he gets up there and he said, "Oh, my God, he's going to see us. I got to shoot him." Boom.
Is his last name Cole? Yeah.
So anyway, he killed this thing. Well, I'm not the smartest guy around, but in retrospect, I got to thinking about this thing. And I thought, you know, I was wondering why the base of that tree was all cleaned out. No leaves, no brush, no nothing around there. I said, you know, I bet that rascal has called from this same tree before. Then I got thinking about it. I said, and I bet most of the birds he killed came on his side.
Yeah, that sounds like a Bobby story.
So
yeah.
Anyway, I remember that experience. And just like all of you who've harvested turkeys and hunted turkeys hundreds of times, you know, you go out and you have wonderful experiences.
Oh, right, yeah.
And so, you know, you just can't remember all those, but I certainly remember that one.
Mm. I remember working at the outhouse in Montgomery, and Paul Maddox, man, you just brought in a turkey that had a beard, but had a couple of hairs that went 16 inches.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Man.
I think it may be like Picasso. The longest beard in Alabama.
May have been shot from the same pine tree.
Yeah, so not. I got one more for you.
Okay.
And be honest. What's the biggest bass you've had a customer grow? You don't have to say where it was, but what's the biggest bass you know one of your clients grew?
15 pounds, 4 ounces.
Boy, that's a hog.
That's a hog. It'd make a big old fillet, wouldn't it, Dudley?
Yeah, and we'll talk about where this was afterwards, if you know. That's a big fish, Doug.
Yeah,
it's huge. All right, guys, this has been fun. Barry, thank you for coming.
Yeah.
You're welcome. We're going to really close it out this time. Lanny, you missed a lot.
I know.
We'll catch you up.
Super intriguing.
Basically, keep those river fish in the river.
I mean, I think I want a little bit of everything in there now.
No, you don't.
All right.
Walleye. We're going all walleye.
Why don't you say goodbye, Dudley?
Goodbye, Dudley.
Get us out of here, Rob.
Thanks for tuning in to this week's episode of the Gamekeeper Podcast. And be sure to tune in again. Subscribe to Gamekeeper Farming for Wildlife magazine and don't miss the Mossy Oak Properties Fistful of Dirt podcast with my good buddy, Ronnie Cuz Strickland.